much interested in the issues of information science, information society, created both a book and a journal called Social Epistemology, which is a term that was initially coined by Jesse Shearer and Margaret Ingham. And one of the early issues of this journal was a series of articles that were done by people from our field. Jonathan Turner and some others were doing that. So I think of Steve as a kind of a bridge figure, thinking of
Steve, I'll just turn it right over to you.
Okay. And I will be speaking for about 30 minutes.
Okay,
and hopefully that will allow enough time for some questions in terms of the various issues I'm going to be raising here. Let me say at the outset, not only are you taping it, but I'm taping this as well. So if there's any problem with what's going on here, because we don't know if that works, my thing's pretty reliable. I tend to put the audio lectures on the on my website. So those of you who are wondering, did he really say that, right, you'd be able to check. Now, let me just say a little bit of how I come into this field. I'm associated primarily with this idea of social epistemology, which philosophers, and I'm trained as my PhD is in history and philosophy of science from the University of Pittsburgh, are relative latecomers to, as far as you guys are concerned, in library and information science, because Jesse Shearer was already talking about this concept in the 1950s and 60s, okay? And the first journal issue in philosophy that was devoted to social epistemology came out in 1987, and I was invited to do that, to be part of that, as a graduate student when I was at Pittsburgh, because people already knew of my interest in this area. So it was seen as this very sort of unique kind of area. Here are people looking at the empirical and normative assumptions behind knowledge production, and in a collective social kind of way. Because as you know, those of you who know anything about the way in which philosophy tends to treat epistemology, it's very much sort of the individual facing the world, right? And that the collective is this kind of afterthought or some kind of, you know, unreflective aggregation of the individual. All right. Now, as it turns out, and I only found this out several years later, that in fact Jesse Shearer was already coining this expression, social epistemology, to talk about the goal of library and information science, and in very concrete kinds of ways, in the ways that would be familiar, you know, from the kinds of things we've been talking about at this conference, in terms of the organization of knowledge resources, how you actually classify your libraries, and making, you know, sort of organizing things in a way that would make it easier not only for people to access things, but also to advance the frontiers of knowledge at the same time. And that was kind of his idea. He's thinking about this in terms of the divide that makes a difference for this field. He's thinking about this largely from the standpoint of a, you know, you might say, pre-technological revolution sense, right? Because there is a sense in which a lot of the issues that concern this field these days tend to be very much driven by the kinds of technologies that are involved. But Jesse Shearer is from sort of the older generation, who's sort of thinking about, you know, you might say, a kind of interactionist, symbolic, even symbolic interactionist approach between the user and the producer of knowledge and the knowledge resources, without having to worry too much about how the actual technological medium is influencing what's going on. Because he's still thinking about books and shelves and stuff like that, for the most part. Okay, and I think that's a very important part of his concern. Now, I only found out about this, that Shearer was involved with social epistemology, in the late 1980s, through a guy named Mark DeMay, who's professor of philosophy at the University of Ghent. We have some people from the University of Ghent here, or at least we did yesterday. I'm not sure if they're here anymore. But the point is, he wrote this book called The Cognitive Paradigm, which I still recommend to people to read who are interested in the sort of interdisciplinary study of knowledge across the natural sciences and the humanities. And it was there that I found out about it, and I started making reference to Shearer in 1996 in a survey piece for the American Philosophical Quarterly on recent research in social epistemology. Basically, start off by saying Shearer is the guy who coined the term. Moreover, about 5 years later, I had a graduate student from Brazil spend a year with me, Tarcísio Zandonade, who has an article in the Library Trends, one of the Library Trends volumes that is in your packet, right? That's on the founders, the heroic figures of the field, and it was through him that I actually found out much more about Shearer, and it was very illuminating. And then, to go up to date, when I met Boyd, which was a couple of years ago at UCLA, I was a visiting professor in the School of Library and Information Science, and there I was running a seminar on social epistemology, and this is, I think, a very important aspect of the story, namely, after the first couple of weeks, where I was sort of giving my perspective and people started to get a measure of what I was up to, they started giving me readings, readings from the field, from Otley and from Michael Buckland and from Rayward and from all the other sort of figures that one associates with this field, and basically getting me up to speed and being very interested in how I respond, given my background in history, philosophy, and sociology of science. And that turned out to be incredibly fruitful, okay? And I think one of the things that I take away from this, all right, because we are having an interdisciplinary encounter here, but I think the important thing I would say to those of you who are primarily think of yourselves as being in library and information science, that you have some unique insight into the nature of knowledge that is not being registered anywhere else in all the other disciplines that are concerned about the nature of knowledge. And so I guess what I would do is I would recommend you try to resist the tendency to try to legitimate yourselves by making it look as though you sound like what everybody else is saying. And rather emphasize the stuff that is distinctive, that you can't find anywhere else outside of your own field. Okay? And I think, in fact, this has been done. I mean, so, like, for example, the resurrection of Otley is very important, because nobody else has heard of Otley but you guys, right? And the point would be to sort of promote this stuff outside of this field as a kind of export product, because I think in terms of, you know, if you want to talk about the trade relations across the disciplines, right, this field, as a lot of fields that are normally regarded as professional schools, are largely import fields, right? You're taking in stuff from other disciplines to legitimate yourself, but you're not really exporting, and you've got some stuff to export, okay? And I think that's a very important point. And also the way in which Neurath is spun in this field. So, for example, I was talking to Frank Webster about Neurath. He didn't know Neurath was a sociologist. And, you know, Frank Webster is one of our distinguished professors of sociology in Britain. And that's not uncommon, right? Because Neurath is thought of as a philosopher who's immediately assimilated to logical positivism. And so all this stuff about isotypes and the sort of public education, all this kind of stuff, is just completely unknown. All right, and even the philosophers, the historians of philosophy, who are currently resurrecting Neurath, are ignoring this stuff. Okay, because they have other fish to fry in resurrecting Neurath. They're trying to score some points in their own intra-disciplinary game. Okay, and so all this isotype stuff sort of muddies the waters, and all this socialism stuff muddies the waters, right? And so there's a point here that I think is very important. Namely, you have a very distinctive kind of perspective to bring out to other disciplines, and I would encourage you to do that, and it certainly has illuminated me tremendously, okay? And that's the spirit in which I want to sort of give the kind of talk I'm talking about today, namely, in a way to sort of, not to tell you things that we already know that we're now enlightening you about, right, but rather to sort of talk about a kind of common space in which we can come up with a sort of new understanding of knowledge that's somewhat different from what any of the disciplines involved currently think about it. And for me, that's kind of what a social epistemology is about, right? It's ultimately about that. Because I'm one of these people who believe that disciplinary boundaries are basically artificial constructions. Okay, artificial in the full sense of that word. Namely, they're human-created, right? But at the same time, they are products of historical and social contingency. And because of that, in principle, they should be able to be reversed. That's always the lesson I take from contingency, reversibility. Right, because there is a tendency, I think, sometimes to think, and I'll be alluding to this later, that because history has gone a certain course, even though it's been contingent, there's some sort of legitimacy just being granted the fact things have happened this way. But the whole point here is contingency, in principle at least, implies reversibility, and that one could do things otherwise. And I'm one of these people who believes that, in fact, we have this vast division of knowledge. Right, it's out there, it's proliferating, it's exfoliating more and more every day, but that in a sense, if we are in some sense, even if only in a residual sense, concerned about knowledge and science, in a sense where we can still use this in the singular, okay, in this kind of normative sense, then we have to think that all of this division is in some sense not the full story, or maybe even in some sense something that has to be brought back, has to be taken back in some way. Okay? And that's why I have always been very attracted, and despite whatever criticisms I may make, I am very sympathetic to the spirit in which a lot of the universalist projects that we heard about yesterday in particular have been promoted. Right? Because at the end of the day, these people have, you know, whether we're talking about Wells or Neurath or Otley or any of these guys, right, they all thought about knowledge and science as kind of what makes human beings human. Right? That's kind of the epitome, right? And there's a there's a sense in which the unity of that, you know, getting a clear grip on that is very important for making us what we are, as opposed to being just some other kind of animal. And I think this is really quite going to be an important issue in the 21st century, because as Darwinism and the Darwinist mentality sort of spreads along and you know, gets across, you know, all sectors of life, the difference between human and non-human is being blurred all the time. Right? And so when that gets blurred, it's also quite easy to sort of think the idea of science or knowledge as a distinctive human quality is also kind of an obsolete thing. All right? Historically, right, with the field of library and information science, the fact that you've had concrete exemplars of science and knowledge that you've fixated on, like the library in particular, right, as the place where all knowledge is gathered together and from which it can be distributed, that's a very important thing, right, because if you no longer believe that there is some kind of unified sense of knowledge that everyone should have equal access to, then the whole symbolic nature of the library as a building or an institution even disappears. Right, so, and of course, as this field's identity has moved from library science to information science, you know, information is a kind of vaguer term, doesn't have that kind of boundedness to it. You know, that's part of the openness of the issue. And also, information is a term that, in a sense, is not merely relevant to the issues of epistemology and knowledge, but also has resonance with thermodynamics, and that is to say, realms that get us beyond the human again. Okay, so all of these things seem to be kind of in the balance here, right? And if you ditch the universalist projects, then a lot of this kind of stuff kind of disappears along with it. And speaking as someone who comes from philosophy and sociology, where now we've had a couple of generations of postmodernism, right? You know, if you take your students who sort of begin life as postmodernists. And kind of start reading Lyotard before they read what Lyotard was criticizing, or worse yet, they read textbooks about Lyotard before they even read Lyotard. You know, there is this issue of trying to make the universalist project vivid. Why was anyone ever concerned about trying to put all of knowledge in one place and trying to have one organizational scheme or anything like that? I mean, those of you who have to teach about this stuff, right? I mean, the hardest thing is in a way to motivate this thing that at prima facie level now seems so obviously ridiculous. Universalism. Okay? And I think your field, library and information science, in a sense, recovers the vividness of what universalism could be about. Because there's a sense in which here are people who dedicated their lives to sort of institutionalize universalism. Whether we're talking about common languages, or we're talking about common buildings, stuff of that kind, and you begin to see what's at stake, why people would want to do it, and you begin to see, at a kind of nuanced level even, what the problems are. Right? And in a sense, you can then sort of say, okay, where are the issues here? You know, how could we disagree? Could we improve this? Should this be ditched in toto? Whatever. And this field is, in a sense, you might say, one of the last stands where it's possible to recover that. Because the guys you still focus on are, for the most part, guys who were universalists and who, you know, had this kind of big picture and were trying to institutionalize it in some way or another. Whereas all the other fields gave it up and don't teach about it anymore even. Okay? So I think there's a very important role here, right? I understand that, you know, in the postmodern condition, you know, we now spend a lot of time, worrying about hegemons and, you know, postcolonialism and not being imperialist and all the rest of it. But there is this other horizon up ahead in the 21st century, which has to do with our blending into the animal kingdom, our re-blending, as it were, back into the animal kingdom. And whereas, as it were, one may wish on some sort of scale to say, well, you know, animals and humans are equal, and if we're going to make room for animals, we should maybe, you know, make euthanasia easier, or we should make abortion easier, things like that, because we have concerns about all these other creatures out there. Okay, there's that kind of issue, which is increasingly, you know, or how we design our children, and should we be designing our children, right? All this, it seems to me, this is the new horizon, right? This is the new horizon. Once you get rid of universalism, which, as it were, was closed under human beings, and now you've sort of spread it open, you now have all this other stuff on the horizon. And where are lines going to be drawn there? Especially given a period where the state, and not only the state, but also international organizations like the United Nations, have retreated. And we have a kind of neoliberal regime, where, as it were, each individual decides for themselves, and, you know, and we just look for emergent effects. Spontaneously self-organizing systems. Okay? And it seems to me that's the more serious, you know, that's the issue on the horizon. Stop worrying about hegemons and imperialists and all the rest of it. That's a very 19th century way of thinking about the problem. Right? The problem is this problem up ahead, and where does one want to start to draw lines, and who should be drawing lines? And thinking more along that kind of issue, okay? I mean, that's at least where I'm coming from on this. And from that standpoint, then, the kind of universalist ambitions of the people in library information science seem very salutary. Okay? Now, I know, you know, the thing that's interesting here, of course, is you've got to always realize, and I'm sure, you know, you all know this already, but let me just say it, that every new generation of people is born with a blank slate, right? And they don't know any history. I mean, this whole idea of there being some kind of genetic memory is false, and that's a real problem for us. It would be a lot better if they actually did know something when they were born. And so as a result, you know, if the only thing you teach them is postmodernism, hey, that's the world. Why are people so caught up with humanity? What an idea, you know? Why did anyone ever believe this? Okay, so, I mean, this is the idea people have about socialism, of course. If you ever try to mention socialism in a classroom. So I mean, I really think that there is something very important, very sort of precious here that this field is still continues to talk about, that I think actually can potentially have a very important normative function in a lot of the intellectual and political debates that we're going to be facing with in the 21st century. Okay, so I come here as a very sympathetic person with a lot of the stuff that may strike a lot of you as being very traditional. Okay, now what I want to talk about here in terms of, I believe that there are two intellectual traditions that one can think about this business of the development of knowledge and how one should think about the organization of knowledge. And I'm going to give you sort of various cuts at this, you know, starting with very broad kind of cuts so you can kind of get a general sense and then try to sort of hone in on things a little bit more. At one level, there's a very recognizable way in which one can think about the development of knowledge, and it's one that goes back to Plato, and it's one that you often see as kind of a very taken for granted kind of view, even in this field. Some people in this conference have sort of spoken this way, and that is, you might say, there is, as it were, a design, a pattern to reality, which our knowledge ideally should be representing, right? And maybe we even knew this in some previous life. You know, Plato has an almost karmic kind of view that there was some in the origin of time or something, everyone knew everything, and then it sort of got forgotten, but you can recover it somehow, right? So Plato talks about anamnesis, right, which is this recovery, this remembering of the original knowledge of things, which is, of course, a very important kind of image in the history of the West. We talk about Prisca Sapientia, you know, the pristine knowledge, you know, before the fall, this kind of stuff. So not only in the Greek tradition, but also in the Judeo-Christian tradition, there's a lot of this as well. And the idea is there is a plan, there's creation, there's the design, and then what we're trying to do is recover it. So we try to get the outlines of the structure, so we want the classification systems working right, and then what we call empirical inquiry are basically attempts to try to remember the stuff that's missing, the gaps, right? Try to fill in the gaps. And we call it empirical inquiry because it's new to us. But in fact, what we're doing is recovering something that in fact was already put there in the beginning of time. Okay? You know, so the place on the shelf for the book, that has yet to be written kind of thing. But there's a subject matter already out there to be to write about. And a lot of our notions of realism come from this. Right? When we talk about realism in philosophy, that's kind of what we're talking about. There's this world out there, and we're trying to figure out what it is. Right? Well, it's like saying there's this big structure out there where we have some, maybe the general contours figured out, but we have to figure out how to slot things into place, and that's why we do some kind of research. Okay? And that's very familiar, and that has quite an interesting kind of history. And very often when people try to get sophisticated about this, especially once you start to get into the Judeo-Christian tradition, where you have this idea of God being a supreme intelligence, it's not just the stuff that's sort of laid out there, but there's someone who actually created it, then one thinks of what are the values of intelligence, and so you start getting up with these ideas of efficiency, actually, that we started talking about here, whereby you want to generate the most phenomena with the fewest assumptions. Right, so you want a very simple system at the outset that can then exfoliate into various subdivisions and so forth, and thereby giving you the panoply of creation. You know, and if you think about the way in which knowledge has been presented through the ages, right, there's an idea, there's a few basic principles or beginning points, and then you sort of move outward by some sort of logical scheme. It's almost like deducible, right? If you knew everything in the world, you could deduce where everything belongs. And God deduces. But unfortunately, we're not God. We can't deduce. We have to discover stuff empirically. So there's this kind of asymmetry there in terms of the epistemic access. Okay? And so then you start to think about, okay, are there logics and things by which we can kind of create new forms of knowledge and so forth? But they're basically knowledge, that is knowledge of stuff that, as it were, was already put there. Okay, that's one view, and I think that's a pretty recognizable view. And it's a view that I think very often is a taken-for-granted view. Okay, well, there's this other view. And this other view is a view, you might say, that registers history more directly in knowledge. So as it were, history isn't just the way by which human beings catch up with God, which is kind of what the first story is, right? The first story is God lays it all out, and then it takes us a while to figure out what it is, right? But there's another story whereby history is actually constitutive. Right? It plays a very important role in laying out what reality is, especially for human beings. And that the fact that we go through a particular history makes a big difference. And that's the kind of idea that I want to draw your attention to. And there's a lot of roots for this kind of idea. One root of this, and they're actually quite connected together more than one might think. One of the problems of intellectual history is that the intellectual history over the years has become much more disciplinized. So one does, like, as it were, the history of psychology or the history of chemistry, right? But a lot of the, these disciplines really only become clearly demarcated from each other in the late 19th, early 20th centuries. So in a sense, if you were actually going back to the period where most of these ideas come from, there wouldn't be these kinds of differences. And so it's very important to keep that in mind when one thinks about things. And so what I want to do here is I want to draw your attention to certain connections between what we now call associationist psychology in the 18th century and the kind of chemistry that's going on in that period that goes on into the 19th century. All right? Because I think that's very important, especially as a kind of prehistory of understanding where the science citation index is coming from. And I'm talking about the science citation index because I really think, for those of you who don't realize that, I think the Science Citation Index is probably the most natural interface point for people outside of library information science to understand what's going on in your field. Okay? So if you want to know, how are we going to start all these people outside of this field to understand what library information science is about, Science Citation Index is a good way to begin, because everybody, no matter what discipline they're in, they understand it, and they have attitudes toward it, they have views about it, and they've encountered it. Okay, so in a sense, that's a very important kind of development in your field that's really had cross-disciplinary provenance, for better or worse. Okay, now, where does that idea come from? Okay, the idea that one could count citations and in some sense, all of these things that, let's say, Robert Merton or Derek de Solla Price came up with, principle of cumulative advantage, where there's a tendency in disciplines for most of the citations to go to a diminishingly small number of researchers in the area. Okay, why would anyone think of this stuff as luminous, epistemologically luminous? Indeed, it is thought that way, right? measures. That's the interesting question. Right? That's the interesting question. Why would anyone have thought this was interesting, sophisticated? Because there is an interesting kind of idea there behind it, and that's the kind of thing that I want to explore a little bit. Now, associationist psychology is normally associated with Britain 18th century Enlightenment thinking. One major guy in the, I mean, most of these guys, what do they have in common? We're talking about David Hartley. I don't know if that name means anything to anyone anymore. Or Joseph Priestley, whose name has gotten mentioned here. Okay, Joseph Priestley is a famous guy. He's part of this. And Joseph Priestley is the guy who's normally portrayed as having lost the debate over the discovery of oxygen to Antoine Lavoisier in the late 18th century. What Priestley and Hartley have in common is they're nonconformist Protestants. Okay. Of a very radical sort, actually. So radical that Hartley was tossed out of the church and was a medical scientist for most of his life. And what these guys were basically saying was that if human beings are allowed, if they don't have the constraint of clerical authority over them, and they don't have any other kind of authority blocking their vision or their thinking or anything like that, all of their ideas will, in fact, not only will they gravitate toward the truth individually, but all individuals will gravitate toward a common truth, which is the truth of, that God has disposed for us and through which we will then rise to heaven and join him. Okay, so there is this kind of it's evangelical, but it's a kind of weird meld of rationalism and evangelism. Okay? And these were the, those of you, I don't know if you know anything about Priestley, but this is the kind of guy whose house was always being burned down whenever he opened his mouth, and eventually he had a slave to flee to America. In order to survive. So that's the kind, and these are the kinds of people, 18th century British Enlightenment, these are the kinds of nonconformist Protestants who have this very interesting kind of view, right? Namely, that if you allow people to think through things, they will gravitate toward the truth. And not only that, of course, because we're talking about Christian worldview, each individual, right, has their autonomous soul, which is very important here, because that means each individual counts equally. Each cider counts equally. Think about time citation index and what's the implicit metaphysics of that when I'm talking to you, right? Because that's kind of what we're trying to get at here. Namely, everybody's created equal, right? And the thing is that, and if left to their own device, everybody will gravitate towards the same truth. Now, of course, some people won't gravitate as quickly as others because there are obstacles in their way and stuff like that, and that's why, we always have to be reforming society. So these people were do-gooders and leftists and all the rest of it, right? We have to reform society to get rid of the barriers and things that are preventing people from gravitating toward this common truth. Okay? And so the idea here is these people, not surprisingly, these associations took a very active interest in probability theory, right? Looking at long-term tendencies, where do they go, right? Especially looking at the way in which one starts to approximate a certain kind of mean, right? These sort of asymptotic relations. And in the philosophy of science, we talk about this idea of the self-correcting thesis. So in other words, how does science make progress? Now, of course, there's this kind of very ordinary view that science accumulates truth, but nobody who's a philosopher really takes that view seriously. I don't think it's taken it for a long time, right? But what a lot of philosophers take seriously is the idea that we're approximating some truth gradually, okay? And as it were, we're looking for empirical indicators that we're actually honing in on something, we're actually converging on something, right? And so from that standpoint, then think about how you're going to use quantitative measures, right? You're going to look at, the most people. One of the evidences, right, that Robert Merton in fact used to talk about the fact that science is a free enterprise is the fact that people don't necessarily cite people who are from their university or anything like that, but they tend to cite the people who are the best. And so even though people come from many different backgrounds, they all tend to cite the same people. Okay? And so what does that show? That shows science is a free enterprise, so regardless of what your background is, you all end up gravitating towards truth. Okay, now this is total rubbish. But where would this idea come from? Where you have to have a certain kind of view about what human beings are about, what their purpose is, what the point of knowledge is. Okay, and it's a very nonconformist Christian where you have this direct relationship with God, but it's one where, in a sense, our secular condition kind of obstructs us to varying degrees, And what we're trying to do is figure out how to get there as quickly as possible. Okay? And so that's a very important part of the equation here in terms of motivating this kind of idea. Because from another standpoint, a standpoint that doesn't get mentioned enough, you say, well, God, if all these people are doing all this research and so forth, aren't they just most of them wasting their time since no one's going to cite them? No, you need all these people to do the research to see the pattern, to see who's the elect, to see where the truth is going, you know, where is salvation going. You need everybody participating in that, and so you can see who's ahead and who's behind. That's very important. You know, so this is part of what's going on here, right? And it seems to me that one needs to kind of keep that in terms of motivating the image, because one of the things that's very striking about this, if we go back to the late 18th century, is that guys like Hartley and Priestley, you know, they don't come up with a science citation index, but they certainly come up with a metaphysics that enables this to be a reasonable response. Is that they're progressive, they're leftist, they're regarded as, you know, kind of guys who are beyond the pale with regard to established forms of authority and so forth, because they're basically imagining that each individual can decide for themselves what's true and what's false. And then they're aggregating it, and then using it as a basis for authority. Okay? So that's part of what's going on. That's very important. Now, the other side of the issue has to do with... let me just one final thing, because we talked a little bit about eugenics and so forth and with H.G. Wells, and to give you a sense of how different they are from H.G. Wells. David Hartley says at one point, well, if it turns out only a few people see a certain kind of truth, then it doesn't mean that everybody else is, you know, just stupid or, you know, backward or something. It means that there are things in their way, and we just have to remove the obstacles, and removing the obstacles in the Enlightenment typically meant education. Say imposing new regime on them, but that was called removing the obstacle, and thereby they would then gravitate to the truth that already a few people had gotten to. Of course, the eugenic response would be, if only a few people would get to the truth, get rid of the rest of them. Right? You eliminate the rest of them. You don't bother. You know, don't waste your time. Don't waste your resources. But Hartley, being a very liberal guy, believing all people are created equal, says we just have to educate them, and they'll all just gravitate. Okay, so this is the idea we're talking about here. Now the other idea, and this is an idea that's in fact very important with the natural sciences, from the natural science side, and Priestley is a guy who's got a foot on both camps, so he is this nonconformist Protestant evangelist kind of guy, but he's also a chemist. And chemistry is very important as a science, especially because chemistry being the science of transformation. Okay? And in particular the relevant slogan here, I mean we heard yesterday, I guess in connection with Neurath, to say, information is transformation. One of you quoted this as a sort of Neurath slogan. And this is very much the chemical mentality, right? In a sense that if physics is concerned with the fundamental elements, and as it were, figuring out where God's starting from, you know, where's God's starting point, right? There's a sense in which the chemistry is concerned about how do you get from the elements to the things we actually see, right? That the people actually see, right? So it's a science of transformation. It's always been like that. And the controversy surrounding alchemy, right, as a kind of precursor to chemistry, was because here are some people claiming they kind of know what's going on, you know, how God figured out the world, and now they're going to do it for themselves. Okay? This idea of transforming essential elements into things that are, as it were, humanly relevant becomes very important. Now, this is another part of the issue here, because we're talking about issues about the way in which, especially with the Science Citation Index, the mentality that leads you to think that some aggregation or combination of quantities can give you qualitative change or qualitative significance. Okay, and chemistry is the intellectual locus for that kind of way of thinking. That you can go from quantity to quality, right? And this happens in a lot of ways. I mean, one of the interesting things about, you know, we heard yesterday, it was unfortunate, your paper, Mutterman's paper, the last part of the paper actually deals with a lot of these kinds of issues, namely the way in which the Science Citation Index and other scientific measures arose from a sort of scientific mentality of how quantity could lead us to think about things in qualitatively different ways. So, for example, if you've got a lot of people gravitating into a certain kind of research area, right, you think, well, this is an area worth pursuing where some major discoveries could be made if we put more resources into it. And that's, of course, a very common kind of way of thinking about things. That's an example of where one looks at quantity as somehow leading to qualitative change. And this is part of the... totality that one finds in Marx and Engels, for example. And recently I had an occasion to look at Engels' Dialectics of Nature. Okay, and one of the things that's very clear, if you look at where Engels is coming from, is that Engels and Marx and Hegel in particular see chemistry as the main natural science. Right? It is where natural law becomes self-conscious. Okay, because not only is natural law these permanent, immutable laws with these immutable elements, but also there is this awareness that these laws will be acting in certain contexts, and there will be certain things combined through these laws, and there will be certain consequences that will produce things that weren't there originally. Right? So there will be, through history, new things that weren't there at the outset. So there's this sort of, so time, history becomes the mode through which the self-consciousness is expressed. And in the natural world, that is chemistry, especially in relation to physics, where physics gives you the primitive elements, but chemistry gives you what happens once you start to transform those elements in various the transformations that result from various combinations. And they're not talking about, you know, nowadays we think about things like, oh, the creation of new elements or something through splitting atoms in an interesting way. No, no, they're talking about pretty simple stuff. They're talking about H2O, okay? I mean, they're talking about, you know, taking the basic elements, right, and putting them together in novel combinations and getting something that's qualitatively different from the outset. And they're very impressed with this, right? They think this is, in a sense, a very sort of productive principle that kind of guides everything. Because I was looking at that just to see exactly, you know, at what point do they get impressed with this principle? It's very early. You know, or, for example, you know, the raising of the temperature of water, right, so for gas, and then you lower it to get ice. They're very impressed with that, too, right, as an example of this. So I'm not saying that the scientific basis of this is necessarily incredibly sophisticated, but there's kind of a lot of metaphysical intuition going on here. And so what happens then is there is this view that quantification in the right sorts of concentration end up producing qualitatively different results and potentially better results. Okay, and this is something that also affects the thinking behind the science citation index. Because you might say, if certain kinds of areas, if a lot of people tend to gravitate to certain kinds of areas, you might think, well, why don't we put our resources in the areas that people aren't gravitating toward? You know, that would be one reasonable response, wouldn't it? But no, people say, no, you support the winners and you let the losers die, okay? Because you think there's some kind of sign out there or something like that. So this idea of quantity, right, turning into making for a qualitative difference becomes a very kind of important signifier there, especially as a directional signifier of indicating progress. Okay, so that's part of what's going on there as well. I've got the signal that I've got to stop shortly, but it seems to me that when we talk, you know, as you, many of you may know, the guy who actually founded the Science Citation Index in its current form, Eugene Garfield, was a chemist. Okay, and was a chemist who studied for a little while with Robert Merton. And it seems to me that looking into this kind of dimension is would probably be quite interesting because Garfield and Derek DeSola Price had connections with John Desmond Bernal in terms of this sort of Marxist orientation, and Bernal as a kind of it was kind of soft focus a bit yesterday maybe, but you know Bernal was a Stalinist. And the thing is that they had a very kind of hard-line dialectical materialist view of science, okay, at the outset here. And this is where, in fact, all this business about privileging chemistry and the dialectics of nature and all of that, it's that part of the Marxist corpus that's actually doing the action here, right? And these guys were tuned into that at least very early on in their thinking. And I'm raising all this because I think that there is a sense in which if you go back to the old associationist ideas of people like Hartley and Priestley, there is something valuable about the idea that, you know, all inquirers are created equal and all this kind of stuff. The democratic character of this is quite important. But the way this ended up sort of evolving, you know, and especially the way in which the whole chemistry imagery ended up getting used, the transformation of quantity into quality, ended up being, you know, wreaking a lot of diabolical consequences with regard to the development of science, especially once it becomes a kind of evaluative mechanism, right? Because essentially now, you know, we're using this kind of mechanism to basically, you know, sort of decide which fields live and die, right? It's using a selection mechanism, essentially. So we've sort of superimposed Darwin on top of this kind. kind of chemical imagery, all right? Because we sort of imagine at the outset that there's something autonomous about this process, right? And this goes back to the 18th century idea again, namely, if you have individuals making decisions for themselves about where to support stuff, they will gravitate toward the truth. And of course, that if that's the image of science that's premier, and Robert Merton continues to promote that idea that scientists are freely deciding where they're going, who they're citing, right, then you end up getting this kind of picture, which you say, okay, we can trust this invisible hand because the people involved are all free. They're not like people who are earning wages and stuff like that. They're really free. They're not like Adam Smith's bogus free guys. These are really free guys, right? But it's the same problem. It's the same problem, but one that we don't question as much in our own domain of knowledge production as we do in, you know, normally in the ordinary capitalist mode of production. So I guess I'll stop here just in the interest of time and so take some questions.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you very much. Yeah. right? This is why the humanities, right? You know, especially especially in a more fashionable part of the humanities, where every week there's a revolution, right? The Science Citation Index does nothing, because one week somebody's being cited, next week they're not being cited at all, right? So you can't get anything out of that, right? But if you've got a field that you imagine to be a relatively closed domain, where people are basically making incremental improvements over principles that have already pretty much laid down. Right, that's chemistry. In fact, Heisenberg talks about chemistry as a closed or dead science in the 1920s. Okay? And so not surprisingly, that becomes kind of, as it were, the template for the kind of way in which one conceptualizes the domain in the Science Citation Index. Right? And when Garfield had this idea of doing the Atlas of Science, right, where you chart all these fields and things like this, right? That only makes sense if you think people are building on previous areas and there'll be some kind of logic to it and there won't be sharp breaks very often. Okay? And chemistry fitted that description in a way much more so than any other discipline after the revolutions in physics in 1905, right, with Einstein in particular. So there's that issue too about, you know, the idea of the closure of the domain as being quite relevant for using SCI as kind of a way of judging what's going on. Yes.
Yeah, another interesting thing about citation analysis is that in fact when you look at Garfield, his work is small, and a handful of people that are doing the whole citation question mapping and discipline as well. The citation, what it is you're citing according to Garfield, makes it point over and over again. What you're actually citing is not a person, an idea.
Right.
So that if I cite you, in fact, your name really doesn't function. That doesn't refer to you anymore. That refers to that idea that I got out of you at that particular time.
That's right. Yeah, but see, the problem is this is Garfield's view of what he's doing, right? I mean, this is the problem. Garfield, one of the things that Garfield never quite figured out was that he does not have proprietary rights over the hermeneutics governing Science Citation Index, right? And that people are, in fact, going to be interpreting what they're doing in different ways. And, of course, there are a lot of people who cite people for strategic reasons, not because they're trying to get their ideas, because they're worried they might be refereeing their article.
Sure.
I'm serious. Come on. Let me give you just to be autobiographical here, social studies of science, the main journal of science studies, it is quite common, those of you who ever participated there, even if your article gets accepted, you get told you ought to be citing X, Y, and Z who've already published in the journal, because of course that will increase the impact factor, right, if you cite other people who published in the journal previously, right? And so that's how the users of this are thinking about it. It may not be Garfield, they have these wonderful, ideational views about what's happening when you're citing, but he never quite grasped that when the people got hold of the tool, they would be using it for their own purposes.
Sure, I know. And what's his response then? His response is, well, if the numbers are high enough, it will all wash out.
Yeah. See, this is the idea of, this is the approximation of the truth thing, right? Right? This is the kind of view we're talking about here, right? Where, there'll be some aberration temporarily, but eventually we'll all asymptotically approximate truth. Exactly. And it's based on a weird metaphysics, right? Which one may wish to question. Yeah. Frank.
Yeah, Frank. I found the whole thing really interesting, but can I just a little supplement? I mean, I enjoy your sympathy for the Universalist project that you saw, and it seems to be very evident in the pioneers' documentation and whatnot. I wasn't entirely sure whether it was some nostalgia from you or anything else. And what I want to ask, and actually I'm broadly, although I have to apologize for missing it late yesterday afternoon, it may have come up there, what I've struck here in this conference is the absence of the name of Foucault. Where does Foucault come in here? Where we carry this? Because Foucault even have a lot to say, and followers of Foucault would have a lot to say about these.
Yeah, but you trash these people in print, Frank. This is devil's advocate.
Thank you.
Well, in a sense, what I'm trying to do is first, you know, in the beginning, I was trying to sort of exhort people here, because actually I think there's some valuable things that this field has that the rest of us don't know about, okay, that I think can easily be very taken for granted here, and that for people from the outside, just turns out to be illuminating, okay, there's that aspect. Now, I understand that within this field, there are some issues as well, so in the sense, you know, the more historically minded people aren't necessarily the central people in this field either, so in the sense we may not have a kind of good representation of the people who are in this field normally. Okay, so there's that kind of issue too. But also I think, with something like a science citation index, there are a lot of different ways in which one can deal with it, right? Of course, there's some people who just capitulate and use it as a basis for evaluation. And of course, then there's others who just sort of think it's totally beyond the pale and just say, look, you know, how can you quantitatively represent these kinds of relations and so forth? And it's very easy to do that kind of deconstruction. And I'm surprised it's actually not done more often, to be perfectly honest. But the difficult question, it seems to me, is why would anyone have thought this was a good thing in the first place? You know, not only because, you know, I understand there's a national security issue, that was alluded to yesterday as well, about the Cold War and World War II and all the rest of it, and I understand all that. But intellectually, what is animating this kind of idea? Why would one want this kind of universal way of getting access to knowledge and so forth? And putting it in this kind of form. And I think this field is actually well equipped to actually tackle that kind of question, all right? Because you're familiar at a concrete level with this kind of material. Like I said, I have some sympathy for the universalist perspective. The problem is that whatever gets enacted in any way gets perverted. But just because it gets perverted all the time, it doesn't mean in principle it's a bad idea. And I think that's where I think postmodernists, you know, sometimes make a kind of illicit slide. You know, just because all the instantiations of the idea have been so far bad, it doesn't follow the idea itself is bad. It may, but the point is, I don't see, that's not a sufficient reason to give up on it. And here, it seems to me, in this field, you do study the concrete instantiations. And you can see how the things went wrong and what was actually good and bad about it and what happened and so forth. I mean, this is a good site for that. I guess that would be my...
That field
fewer. I agree. In fact, in the period that you're concerned about with the Fabians in the late 19th, early 20th century, you know, to Carl Pearson and people of that, the people of that ilk, there is a live debate going on about whether one can make, you know, as it were, cuts in the different, you know, in different statistical, you know, 30%, 40%, 50%, doing something or another, and then say beyond 50%, things suddenly change. Whether it's possible to make that kind of leap from quantity to quality, or whether one has to always stick with a kind of quantitatively continuous category when dealing with the probabilities. There's actually a theoretical debate, you might say, within this community about that. But you're right, people who have the kind of chemistry viewpoint believe, yes, you can start to say, beyond a certain point, we move into a new world, even though what we're talking about is just an incremental difference from the last thing. Yeah, but that's a real active debate at the turn of the century with regard to how to interpret statistical data. But you're right, there are these chemical people who do look at statistics as kind of a way of going from quantity to quality. So it's an open question, but you're right. There are people, and they won, of course, they won. Because, of course, we think if unemployment goes beyond a certain rate, it's bad. If it goes below a certain rate, we have no unemployment at all, even if it's 1%.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd love to continue.
Sorry.
We're actually short, actually, I know, but it's so interesting, and it's touching on so many things. And I respond very much to your initial adjuration, so I think that's very good for that. But what, Steve, I'd love to do is to thank you very much. And we'll make sure that people know about the website. And of course, there will be a paper in the book that will come out of all of this. So we'll be able to follow those ideas.
Yeah,
and then everybody can write you.
Please, I hope we go beyond that at some point.
We'll converge on your truth.
Yeah, all right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great stuff, Steve.
Thank you.